Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're joined by a very special guest, attorney John Mitchell. John is a partner in the Taft Law Firm, and his specialty is compliance, investigations, and white-collar defense and commercial litigation. He's an award-winning lawyer, a very successful litigator, and he spends much of his professional time defending white-collar crime cases. John was an earlier guest on this podcast, and we're delighted to have him back. And today we're going to be talking about sentencing guidelines, what they are, and what exactly do they do. Gail, you were very successful in getting John to come back on our podcast. It's always a delight to talk with him. So I'm going to let you lead this discussion off, and I may jump in at any time as the translator if we get too far in the weeds here.
Well, thanks so much, Tom. And I want to say, John, welcome to Next Witness, Please. We are so honored and delighted to have you back to talk to us about sentencing guidelines, which is a term of art in legalese that we hear a lot, but I suspect our listeners have no real context for what it is or how it's applied. So I'd like to actually start our conversation with what we like to do for our audience, which is just asking, what are sentencing guidelines? If you can just provide us a layman's definition.
Sure. Well, first, it's nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
You must be a glutton for punishment.
Why should work be any different than home?
There you go.
Yeah. So in a general sense, the sentencing guidelines are a statutory framework that's used to determine the appropriate sentence for a federal defendant, either a company or an individual. And the purpose of the sentencing guidelines, they were enacted in 1987. And it really was, you know, commonly when I get a new client will come in and they're apprehensive and they're worried, and they'll say at some point during the first conversation, what am I looking at? And oftentimes my answer is tell me who my judge is, right? And because you can, particularly in our state court here in Cuyahoga County, we have 36 judges. There's 36 unique personalities who may view 36 sets of facts in a different way. Mm-hmm. Or one set of facts, 36 different ways would be more appropriate. And so the purpose of the sentencing guidelines is to kind of eliminate disparity between sentences. And to give you kind of an example, if you're a criminal defendant and there's a random draw and you get your judge and two of your choices are, you know, Judge Roy Bean or King Solomon, right? I think most people would say, I'd really like to pitch my story to King Solomon rather than Judge Roy Bean, because you've got the hanging judge versus the judge universally recognized for wisdom. And that plays out in the real world where you have judges have different judicial philosophies. They have different things that they view with different levels of seriousness. And the sentencing guidelines were commissioned. There was a sentencing commission put together. They did a ton of research. And what they realized were oftentimes people with similar sets of facts ended up with different, wildly different, disparate sentences. And the sentencing guidelines were enacted after the significant research to kind of bring a uniformity to, or a predictability to, what a criminal defendant should look at or should face when facing sentences. So there's some predictability in the system.
John, on the sentencing commission that did all this research before it went to Congress to enact, Who was on that? I don't mean individuals, but were they all judges? Were they academics? How did that work?
No, it was a healthy slice of the criminal justice system. There were prosecutors, assistant United States attorneys. There were judges. There were defense lawyers. The federal defenders participated. They had academics. I believe there were people from the probation department. So it was kind of a slice of what I would call those who had a stake in the system. And the commission is in existence today, Judge Tom. I mean, they still meet regularly. And later on in this program, I'm going to talk about a significant change that went into effect on November 1st. So they still meet, they still review things, they still try to further this mission of bringing some predictability and avoiding disparate sentences.
What can I just jump in and ask, for our listeners' benefit, why bother avoiding disparate sentences if, these are criminal penalties for which defendants will no doubt deserve or require a sanction?
Well, because, going back to my King Solomon or Judge Roy Bean example, I mean, if you come walking in and, let's say you've stolen, $1,000. I mean, Judge Roy Bean arguably would want to throw the book at you. And whereas King Solomon might come up with a more reasonable sentence. But, if you take a look at the way our criminal justice system works, I mean, we have prisons, we have places to put people, but they're not open-ended. I mean, there are only so many slots in jail. And really the question is what is the fair thing to do for a criminal defendant? Mm-hmm. And if you've got disparate sentences that are personality driven because of a particular jurist view of the law, that really undermines confidence in the system when people are getting sentences that are extremely draconian and undeserved, when somebody who just because they got sentenced by a different judge, maybe in a different state, walks out the courtroom the same day. And so I think in our criminal justice system, predictability can be a good thing. And understanding what a potential defendant is facing, particularly when that I'll talk about later, incentives built into the guidelines for people to plea rather than go to trial. Bringing that predictability, I think, is something good. And, because every defendant's going to ask you at one time, what am I looking at? What are the potential penalties here?
Meaning, what's the worst that can happen?
Well, what's the worst, but
what's likely?
What's likely, right? What could happen? Mm-hmm. The sentencing guidelines were put in place to kind of bring some predictability and at least some objective criteria that judges were forced to consider in order to, to give someone a sentence.
John, you hear the term mandatory and advisory around sentencing guidelines. First, could you explain those terms as they apply to sentencing guidelines? And two, where do we stand with whether they're mandatory or advisory?
Sure. So the sentencing guidelines cover felony violations and Class A misdemeanors in the federal system. And my comments today are limited to the federal systems. Some states have put sentencing frameworks in, some haven't. In Ohio, there's an effort to get a sentencing database up and going to kind of track and bring some data, for lack of a better phrase, surrounding how sentences are imposed in Ohio. But to your question, what are mandatory and advisory? So originally, when the sentencing guidelines were passed in 1987, the guidelines were mandatory. Let me be more precise. The guidelines were mandatory, which means that if the court went through a sentencing analysis and made a determination of a sentencing guideline and then went to the chart and determined what the sentence was, the court had to impose that sentence. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. You had to give a mandatory guidelines sentence. That changed when the United States Supreme Court issued its decision in United States versus Booker, which said that it found that the guidelines as originally constituted violated the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, and it held that the guidelines are now advisory, which means that the judge is the ultimate arbiter of the sentence, it can use and it must use the guidelines as a starting point to determine the sentence, but the judge had the ultimate determination in terms of what that sentence would be. And to give you a real world example, I represented a client who had been arrested and caught with a tremendous amount of crack cocaine. Because he was sentenced at the time when the sentencing guidelines were mandatory, he received a life sentence. He went to prison the year before I took the bar, and we're about the same age. President Obama put a clemency program in place that went back and looked at some of these people who'd been sentenced under the mandatory sentencing framework and, you know, said if you met certain criteria, like you weren't a member of a gang, that you hadn't been in trouble, that you were sentenced under a sentencing rubric that was more lenient today. For example, if you'd been sentenced today, you would have got a lesser sentence. He would take a look at awarding those clients clemency. And my client did receive clemency. So, you take a human being who would, at age, mid-20s, was going to spend the next 60 years in prison. It resulted in what I thought was a very fair opportunity for him to reclaim his life and to go on and do things, good things for society, rather than sit inside a federal prison for the rest of his life. But that mandatory guidelines requirement that you have to file the guidelines, that is gone now. So the sentences are, the guidelines are advisory, which meaning the judge must analyze them, must take a look, must consider them, but is not bound to give a strict guideline sentence when implementing the sentence or implementing the sentence at sentencing time.
Now, John, I think you mentioned something when you were explaining this process about a grid, or there's a grid system. What is that and how does that factor into how the guidelines are actually applied?
Well, all these things are online. If you Google United States Sentencing Guidelines, you'll go right to, it's the first link that pops up. Mm-hmm. They have actually a calculator on there where you can go if you're under indictment or think you might be, you can actually plug in the numbers and try and figure out what may or may not apply.
Do you tell your clients to just check out the calculator?
Well, that's the funny thing. A lot of them do, Judge Gale, and then they come in and say, hey, look, I'm going to do 6 months. And then you sit down and have to explain to them why their analysis are off or certain guidelines aren't going to apply or this doesn't matter or that doesn't matter. So, the sentencing guidelines are extremely complicated. There's reams of case law about them. And today I'm going to talk in generalities because you can't address any specific. I mean, this podcast is useful for information purposes, but not for direct application to your
case. No. And we have no intention of providing direct legal advice to any listener whatsoever.
So to answer your question about the sentencing chart, and the sentencing chart determines the sentence, the guidelines sentence for a particular defendant. And this is, I know we're on a podcast and we don't have the ability to post it, but if anyone's listening, it's worth taking a look at, because if you look at it, it's a grid. Across the top horizontally is the defendant's criminal history category, which examines the defendant's criminal history, whether they're past convictions and sentences that an individual has received, and it determines the defendant's criminal history, which is, a zero all the way up to, like, I think it's nine. Then if you go vertically down the left-hand side, that is the offense level. And as you go down the page on the left-hand side, the offense level increases as you go towards the bottom of the chart. Mm-hmm. And it lists in potential sentences, or it determines an offense level that then translates as you go right across the page to a potential sentence. Now, also staggered across the chart, running from left to right, are the zones. The zones use, if the court gives a guideline sentence, the zones dictate the court's options in terms of sentencing a defendant. So the higher the criminal history, the zones are staggered in a way that make imprisonment more likely. So to give you a real-world example, if a defendant in a criminal history category 1, which means they don't have any previous record, and you went to an offense level 12, That would be in a zone C, which would require the court to give a sentence of imprisonment or a split sentence. And that person would be looking at a sentence of from 10 to 16 months. Now, if you go to the same offense level, 12, and the defendant is in a criminal category 4, and an offense level 12, they're automatically in a zone D, which means that they are facing a sentence of imprisonment if the court gives a guideline sentence, and the sentence range is from 21 to 27 months. So, when you look at it, it's not that hard to translate it. I've tried my best understanding that we don't have visual capabilities here. But the chart is how, if a court imposes a guideline sentence, what the potential range of sentences would be based on the defendant's criminal history, based on the offense level, and where they fall in which particular zone. There are four zones. Zone A allows for a sentence of fine or a sentence of probation with or without a condition of community confinement or home detention and a sentence of imprisonment, right? And most offenders in a zone A are going to go home on probation. In zone B, the guidelines allow for a sentence of probation with a condition of community confinement or home detentions, a split sentence, and a sentence of imprisonment. If you go to a zone C, as I said moments ago, the guidelines allow for either a split sentence and a sentence of imprisonment. And if you get a split sentence, you have to do at least half of your sentence in incarceration.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And if you do zone D, you're looking at a sentence of imprisonment. Now, understanding that, to use Judge Tom's appropriate word, these are advisory, the court still must go through an analysis to determine what the potential guideline sentence would be. But if you hear the phrase guideline sentence, it gets thrown around on these Law and Order shows.
That's why we're having this conversation.
Yep. What we're talking about here is really a framework that's put in place to determine the appropriate sentence if a court decides to give a guideline sentence. But to Judge Tom's other point, these are no longer mandatory. So when I started, they were, but they're not now. And the court has a lot greater flexibility in giving or determining what an appropriate sentence should be.
John, on that point, though, if a court say, let's say it's a zone A type thing, and the person should probably get a fine and probation, but the judge has a burr in his saddle and decides, no, I'm going to sentence this person to the max, and deviates from the guidelines. Or the other example, somebody's supposed to go to prison, but the judge gives them straight probation. When a judge deviates from the guidelines, what does the judge have to do? What is the judge's obligation to the parties and to the victims and to the public?
Now, this has never appeared on TV, but we're going to talk about 18 USC 3553.
Okay.
Right? That is the controlling statute that determines the sentence of a defendant or a corporation when they're in front of the judge. And what the court is required to do is to impose a sentence that is sufficient, but not greater than necessary to comply with the purposes of sentencing, right? And if you go to 18 USC 3553, you'll see the first thing the court's required to look at is the nature and circumstances of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant. So they have to take a look at, who is standing in front of me and what did they do, right? But going back to finding a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary, that is contained in A2, which talks about the need for the sentence imposed to reflect the seriousness of the offense, to promote respect for the law, and to provide just punishment for the offense. Another consideration under A2 is to afford adequate deterrence to criminal conduct. In other words, if somebody sees that, John Mitchell broke the law and sentences and is sentenced to X number of months in federal prison, is that going to, provide adequate deterrent to others? And I will tell you, there's reams of publications that address the real efficacy of deterrence. Another part of A2 is to protect the public from future crimes of the defendant. And the last is to provide the defendant with the needed educational or vocational training, medical care, and any other corrective measures they need in the most effective manner. So when the court is determining the sentence, they look at the A2 factors to impose a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the purposes set forth in A2. The court's going to walk through, as I said, the nature and circumstance of the offense and the characteristics of the defendant, the need for the sentence to impose. They're going to look at the kind of sentences available, the sentencing ranges, if they're applicable. And what they put in 6, which kind of underlies where we started here, is the need to avoid unwarranted sentence disparities among defendants with similar records who've been found guilty of similar conduct. So what you're trying to do, again, is just because someone's sentenced in Oregon, they shouldn't be treated any more harshly than someone who's sentenced in Virginia. And the overall purpose of the guidelines is to kind of analyze the data that exists so that judges can make more informed sentences. So, you know, we're getting ahead here, but at some point, the probation department will do an analysis of offenders who have pled guilty to that particular offense and who fall within a sentencing level, meet the same offense level. And the probation department will say, you know, judge, 18 people in the United States in 2024 were sentenced for violations of 18 USC whatever and ended up in an offense level 7. The average sentence for those people was X. So when a judge sits down and says, okay, you know, I'm not sure what to do with this defendant who did X, Y, and Z, they have a record in front of them saying, okay, other judges who have analyzed these kinds of sentences have determined that this would be the appropriate sentence. So that's a long way of answering your question, Tom. I hope I did somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But it since the guidelines are no longer mandatory, it's the 18 USC 3553 factors which really ultimately drive the sentence for the court.
One quick clarification, then I'll turn back to Judge Gale. And that is, if the judge, though, goes way off the beam on the guidelines, does the judge have to explain on the record? Does there have to be a paper trail? Or is it just totally in the judge's discretion?
Or is an appeal available?
So the answer to all those questions are, yes, the judge must specifically make the findings. The judge will cut a sentencing entry that, frankly, it's a pre-printed piece of paper that they check off certain boxes. And then Judge Gale, to your point, yes, the defendant can appeal the sentence unless there is a prohibition in their plea agreement that would prevent them from taking an appeal. Usually what that prohibition says, look, you can't appeal if you get a sentence within the sentencing guidelines, I should be more precise. What it'll say is, look, you can't appeal unless the judge gives you more than is statutorily allowed for that particular offense. So if you're pleading guilty to, you know, I don't know, a conspiracy case and the sentence is 20 years and the judge gives you 25, I mean, that they can't do that. So you can take an appeal under those circumstances.
Or to make the even more marked, you know, a death sentence for shoplifting, right?
Perfect example, Judge Tom.
But it also sounds like, if I'm correct, John, under these, you know, guidelines, it may or could, and correct me if I'm wrong, perhaps limit the ability of defense attorneys and prosecutors to negotiate an agreed upon sentence.
No, that's right. And I mean, you can in rare circumstances enter into a plea where the judge is required to give a guideline sentence. It's called a C plea, right? Where you say, look, judge, you can't go down and you can't go up. You got to give a sentencing within those range. And occasionally they will agree to do it. I mean, most judges look at you like, no, this is my job. I'm not going to agree to that. Most plea agreements have a requirement in there that says, look, we can make a recommendation in terms of where we think the offense level is, but it's up to the court to make the ultimate determination. And when you do the plea colloquy, I mean, the judge will make that point, say, look, I understand we've got a recommendation under this agreement, but I'm the ultimate decider of what the appropriate sentence would be. So, yes, I mean, that can happen. And look, to get ahead of where we were going, in November, there was a real change in the sentencing guidelines, right? Because the way that they're supposed to operate is, you know, you have a guilty plea or a conviction after trial. You know, you've got an individual or a corporation. Now, if it's an individual, they're facing a potential threat to their liberty, restitution, fines, and there are special assessments out there that defendants are required to pay, which constitutes $100 per count. So if you plead guilty to four counts, you got a $400 special assessment. If you're a corporation, you're facing many of the same penalties, with the exception of, you know, of course, there's no threat to a corporation's liberty, right? You can't incarcerate, you know, Joe's tire shop, right? You can only
probably, and Joe's tire shop probably doesn't care about $100 assessment.
Yeah, probably not. So when you're walking through the guidelines, again, they're no longer mandatory. The court still has to make a guidelines analysis. You know, that focuses on, as we talked about, the offense conduct and the 18 U.S.C. 3553 factors. And when you get down to like the mechanics of how the guidelines are put into place, you know, they start with determining the offense level and what guideline applies. And then there's a three-step process that was implemented as recently as November 1st, right? You know, step one is we're going to determine what's the base offense level, right? And the judges begin by identifying the base offense level for a crime as outlined in the guidelines. And it's not complicated. There's an appendix in the back of the guidelines that says, look, if you pled guilty to 18 U.S.C. XXX, you're going to apply guideline X. So you flip to guideline X, and a lot of times they have a base offense level. So if you take like the most common thing we encounter in the white collar world are people taking vast sums of money that don't belong to them. So they typically fall within the larceny, embezzlement, and other forms of theft category in that guideline. And if you go to 2B1.1, in the guidelines manual, it'll tell you that the base offense level for a violation of that guideline is generally a 7. Not always, but usually a 7. Okay, so if you go back to our sentencing chart we just started with and talked about 10 minutes ago, you go down the left-hand side and you go, okay, I'm at an offense level 7. So if you're at a 7, you're already out of a zone A, you're into a zone B, but that's the base offense level, okay? That's exactly, that's what you're being charged with if a number of potential enhancers didn't apply. So you start with 7, then you go to, as I said, 2B1.1, and in that guideline, there are that you can raise the level based on the amount of money that was taken. So if you took more than $6,500 but less than $15,000, you would add 2. So you started at a 7, now you add 2, you're at a 9. If you'd taken more than $1.5 million, I'm not going to give you the whole chart, I'm bouncing around here. If you'd taken more than $1.5 million but less than $3.5 million, you add 16. So you're at 7, you add 16, now you're at 24, or 23, excuse 23. Me. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, you know, you get the Bernie Madoffs of the world, right, who took billions or whatever he's alleged to have taken. So the highest level is if you've taken more than $550 million, you add 30 points. So you start at a 7, you add 30, and now you're at a 37. And then an additional potential enhancements are, you know, there's specific offense characteristics outlined in the guideline. So, for example, if your crime involved 10 or more victims, you know, was committed through like a mass marketing scheme where you've sent, you know, email blasts out and flyers out, or it resulted in substantial financial hardship to one or more victims, you increase by two levels.
Is that what you mean by the Bernie Madoffs when, you know, victims pretty much lost everything?
Everything. If it's more than five or more victims, it's increased by four. And if it's 25 or more victims, it can increase by six. So that's how a guy like Bernie Madoff ends up with a life sentence, right? Because he started at seven, he added 30, and then he added another six. And you're literally at a 43, which is the highest level, which is a life imprisonment in a zone D. You're going to go. So the first step to bring this back around, the first step is, you know, we're going to determine the base offense level and what the offense level is for that particular defendant. Okay. The second step is we're going to apply adjustments. All right. So there are aggravating factors and mitigating factors. Okay. And if, for example, an aggravating factor is, you know, or excuse me, well, let's start with victim related adjustments. I mean, was this a hate crime? Was somebody targeted because of their, you know, ethnicity or religious beliefs? Was this person an official victim? You know, were they a government official or somebody who recently had left the government or, you know, a Secret Service or an FBI agent? I mean, those result in adjustments upward as well. I mean, they take a look at what is your role in the offense. And these are designed, guys, to account for the specific circumstances of each case. You can see
whether you were a mastermind or a flunky, right?
Right, correct. Or you know, a lot of times, none of these even apply, right? Because, you know, I mean, if Bernie Madoff did what he did and then went out and, you know, fleeing the jurisdiction, got in a gunfight with an FBI agent, you know, I mean, that's when these things start to come into place. The idea is to capture as much as we can and kind of assign it a numerical value.
Can I ask John real quick, are these kind of akin to what are often known as kind of specifications or in like charge enhancements if they had been at the state level?
Yes, that's a very good analogy, Judge Gale. So whereas in a state indictment might contain, a charge with, you know, a gun spec to your comment or something like that.
Or that's elderly spec.
Correct. Correct. Okay. Correct. So, you know, if you go to the role in the offense, I mean, was this person an organizer versus a manager of five or more participants? Did they have a mitigating role? Were they a minimal participant versus a minor participant? And these terms are defined in the guidelines and based upon a defendant's role in the criminal offense, they can, you know, either have their sentence enhanced or increased their offense level, or it could be reduced. The most common one you'll hear about is acceptance of responsibility. And when I started, you know, I talked a little bit about when people plead guilty, one of the real incentives to do so is the ability to accrue points for acceptance of responsibility, because that adjustment moves the number lower. So if you plead guilty, regardless of the offense, you're automatically going to get 2 points down on your sentence. If your offense level is 16 or higher, you get to deduct an additional point. So if you're in this Bernie Madoff range and you're trying to get your sentence down, if you plead guilty, you're going to lose 3 points. So if you're at, who knows, a 25, you go down to a 22. So after the judge has considered the adjustments, the next thing they're going to do is look at what they used to do, I should start with, was they would consider variances and they would also consider downward departures, which were specifically identified and enumerated in the guidelines for that you could get points down for, right? In the old days, we used to have what was commonly called a 5K1, right? Did the defendant plead guilty and did he provide what's called substantial assistance to the government? But you used to be able to get downward departures for family ties, if your crime was committed under extreme duress. And these were all defined, and there was a whole body of case law that would explain when you should use this particular departure. The judge was also able to use what are called variances, which arise after an analysis of 18 U.S.C. 355A, you know, the offense nature, the defendant's history, those kinds of things. And those were variances were different in that they were not specifically enumerated in the guidelines as departures. And guys, I mean, look, we've been talking for 35 minutes and you can see how complicated this gets, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
and you know, you're sitting there reading this stuff. And on one hand, you've got, you know, your Lexus account open. And in the other hand, you've got your calculator, right? But as of November 1st, the guidelines eliminated departures and variances.
So there's no incentive anymore for pleading guilty. There's no incentive anymore for taking.
That's still there. Okay.
Okay.
But the departures, such as the 5K1 and other things and other variances, those have been specifically eliminated.
As of November 1st, where does a person's past criminal record, if any, come into play?
Well, that's still going to come into play because that's under, again, we're now using 18 U.S.C. 3553. One of the first things that you have to look at is going to be the defendant's, the nature and circumstances of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant. So the court is always going to look at that and statutorily obligated to do so.
Okay, so if a person, let's say, is charged with embezzlement of $1 million, just hypothetically, and the probation department does a criminal records check on them and finds that they had a minor misdemeanor marijuana back in college. You know, does the criminal history have to be related to the crime at the moment? Or is it a total pattern of conduct or both?
Meaning any criminal history whatsoever.
Right.
Don't hold me to this, but I think you can only go back 10 years.
Okay.
For the analysis of the criminal histories. And the criminal history, by the way, doesn't start from the day you pled. It starts from the day you're released from custody. And it's been a long time. So the question is, you know, was that person, if they were sentenced on day one or pled guilty on day one, they were sentenced on day 90, and then they reported to jail on day 365. And then they get out of jail on day 1000. For the purposes of going back, day 1000 is the last date. So when you're analyzing someone's criminal history, and there's some crimes that I don't know if they are actually, that 10-year application would apply, right? I mean, I suspect child sex crimes or internet pornography of children and things like that.
Murder. I mean, you should probably be like, we always care about this.
Yeah, right. So I think I've answered your question, Judge Tom, but the big picture here is, you know, it's going to depend on the offense, and the defendant's previous record is going to be important because when you're, again, we're going back to our chart now, we're going across the top, the defendant's criminal history category, what their criminal record looks like in the past is going to determine whether they're in a category one or they're in a category seven. It always matters, and it's always something that is germane that the court can consider.
One other question, and I'll let Judge Gale jump in here. But you said earlier in our conversation that the sentencing guidelines and perhaps even the November 1 changes act as incentives to plea bargaining. Could you explain that in lay terms, what you meant by that?
Yeah, I can. So I'm going to take a step back here. Look, when you sit down with a criminal defendant, and one of the early decisions you have to make is, look, are we going to surrender? Are we going to fight? Right? Are we going to enter a plea, or are we going to go to trial? And you know, I haven't seen any research on this, but I think there's a difference. And look, you're both former judges; you can talk on this too. Look, when a judge tries a case and the defendant's convicted, they're not supposed to treat them any more harshly than if they had pled guilty. They're not. And I believe that most judges, almost all judges, follow this. So when a defendant comes in and he says, you know, I've been charged with this, or this is what I've been indicted with, you have to make a decision early on. Are you going to fight, or are you going to surrender, right? And Tom, I want you to hold that thought about how the guidelines work in favor of people who plead guilty, okay?
Got it.
You sit down, you analyze the facts of the case, you work through all the documents, you meet the client, you talk to potential witnesses, you do what you can, and then you say, look, we've got to make this decision. What are we going to do? And I believe that, as I said moments ago, judges aren't supposed to sentence you worse if you plea or if you go to trial, because that's an infringement on your right to a trial, right? No one should be treated more harshly because they chose to exercise their constitutional rights.
Like the trial tax.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, Judge Gale. So if you're a judge and you have to sentence someone who's broken the law, you're going to get a pre-sentence investigative report either way, okay? If they went to trial or if they pled, you're going to get a pre-sentence investigative report. But if you've gone to trial, the judge has heard in very real terms from the victims the problems that your conduct caused, how you violated the law. If you've pled guilty, then they're just reading that on the piece of paper, and I don't think it has nearly the same impact. So I don't think that any jurist says, look, this guy tried this case, I'm going to whack him because he went to trial. They shouldn't, and that's
no.
That is the complete trial tax, right? But as human beings, when you sit there and have a crying victim in the witness chair explaining how she trusted some investment advisor with her life savings and the guy spent it on Ferraris, I mean, it is impossible not to be swayed by that. So under the guidelines, if a defendant enters a guilty plea, they get either 2 to 3 points off for acceptance of responsibility. So if I've gone to trial, I'm going to be, say, an offense level 20. If I've pled guilty to the same offense, I'm going to be in an offense level 17. That's the enhancement. That's the benefit to pleading guilty. That's what that's what you're going to get out of the guidelines if you choose to plead guilty prior to or instead of trying your case. So there's that automatic enhancement built into the sentencing guidelines. And I don't think anyone sat around and said, we're going to do this for some nefarious purpose. I think it was just a result of, hey, people accept responsibility should be rewarded. Hey, we've got a system here that has thousands of defendants in it. We've got to move these cases through. Bringing predictability is one of the benefits to having a sentencing guidelines, and also enabling the defendant to get through the system more quickly. We're going to give them points for that.
And I would also say, John, to your point, something you mentioned is so important, which is that when there is a plea in a case, and this may to some degree be strategic, it also, as you said, kind of shields the judge, if you will, from hearing all of the granular details.
Yeah.
Of what the case itself may have entailed, things that you may hear through testimony or the presentation of exhibits or documents or other tangible evidence. You won't have that happen if there is a plea and just an acceptance of responsibility, because again, to some degree, you may have you could have the cancellation of that. I recall having a case in particular, and it was a pretty challenging case, because what I sensed early on was that there was a reason why the defense never wanted to go to trial. They did not want witnesses to take the stand. The defendant's behavior had been so abhorrent that I think they believed that there was just no, that the defendant would at least appear to be irredeemable. And therefore, a plea was probably the best way to resolve the matter. The prosecution, you know, was comfortable one way or another. But one thing you mentioned when it comes to sentencing and whether or not the court imposes something mandatorily, you cannot escape the human element of judges just being human beings and hearing and experiencing the trauma of victims or the evidence that comes out. And that's very different from what you'll ever read in a pre-sentence investigation, no matter how long and detailed it is. And the judges are always going to take that into consideration, I think.
Well, the example I tell clients are, look, if I say to you, go see a movie, you're going to sit down and see the movie and experience everything, right? If you come to me and say, tell me about this movie, I'm going to give you the same information, but you're not there. It's not going to have the same impact on you as a person. And that translates in the sentencing world as well, indeed, right? If the movie's the trial and the PSI, I mean, the judge's going to get a PSI either way. But if they've lived through the movie and read about it.
That's a pre-sentence investigation, folks.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Tom. I was really trying to avoid slipping into the lingo. But if you've seen the movie, then read the review, it's different than just reading the review, even if it has the same information. So that's a way to think about it.
Now, one thing I want to do before we wrap up here, because you do have the benefit, John, of being here with two retired judges. And I know Judge Tom has an opinion about mandatory sentences and how they impact the work of judges. So, Judge, I'd love to hear from you what your gut reaction has been about, you know, either guidelines, mandatory or discretionary sentences in your experience.
I think at federal level, I think it's important, especially when you have lifetime tenure judges, to have some kind of sentencing guidelines. I'm encouraged to know that the commission is still in place, and this is sort of a living, breathing, evolving kind of thing over the last several decades and hopefully on into the future. However, at a state level, if your state level judge is elected, and I was an elected judge in Ohio, and all judges in Ohio are elected, it seems to me that part of that process is people vote for you as they how they think that you will handle cases, and they're voting for your particular discretion and not necessarily for guideline uniformity. If you're a judge in Athens, Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, or Cleveland, you might have different circumstances depending on the crime and depending on the constituents that you report to. So that's just my view. I think they're great on the federal level. If you have an elected system on the state level, I'm not so sure.
Well, I think, look, Justice Scalia never called me and said, this is why I ruled this way in Booker. But I think that was something that the Supreme Court certainly considered, right? I mean, you've got these folks up there, the nine of them, who are all incredibly accomplished jurists. They've been appointed as federal judges, so they've already been through Congress once. And then they come back and they become United States Supreme Court justices. But they remember the days on the bench. And it didn't make a lot of sense to me to tell somebody, hey, you're this accomplished attorney. You're in the courtroom. You're on the front line. We want you to do your job that requires you to give mandatory sentences. So all you're doing is applying a chart. And I think taking that discretion away from jurists was not a good thing. And when the Supreme Court rendered its Booker decision, that's what they did. They gave that power back to the frontline judges to ultimately impose the sentence. And I think that was a good thing.
John, just one last question, and I know we're running out of time, but I know you sort of prepared an outline of things that we should talk about. Have we missed anything that's really important for our listeners to know?
I'm scanning that outline right now. I think we've covered about everything. Just to touch on, I mean, some criticism of the guidelines are, you know, is that sometimes the numbers that are the base offense levels seem to be pulled out of whole cloth. You know, so for example, I mean, there aren't many of these cases, but RICO cases. I mean, if you're convicted of a RICO offense, you're going to start at a 19, or at the level of the most serious underlying predicate act, for example, a murder. So, you know, if you start at 19, you're starting at 30 to 37 months in a criminal history zero. And, you know, before you even done anything, right? And if you're right. A low-level participant, oh, by the way, you're in a zone D too, so you're going. So if the judge gives a guideline sentence, you're starting at a 19, going to prison for at least 30 months. And, you know, as we walk through the enhancements and the other things we talked about in the past, suddenly that number gets a lot bigger, right? Now, who determined that a 19 was the appropriate level?
Well, and there are more and more RICO prosecutions at state and federal levels.
Right.
On all kinds of criminal enterprises, from street crime clear up to very organized crime.
Very unique applications, I think, of that statute.
Yeah, I mean, it was designed specifically to go after the mob, and it's being used in ways that I don't think the drafters had ever even thought of. And so, you know, I talked about that in the last podcast, how we're seeing a rise of RICO cases, but you're going to start at a 19 if you're convicted, right? Which means that somewhere, somehow, you're being equated to a member of a criminal organization, La Cosa Nostra, right? Even if you've committed a RICO offense. So to me, that's...
You know, you could be a street bookie and you're, right. You're all of a sudden...
Right. All of a sudden, you're Luca Brasi, you know? I mean...
Yeah, right.
I mean, and there are more criticisms that have come out, but I mean, you know, I take tremendous comfort in the fact that, you know, the people putting the guidelines together are really trying hard to get it right. I mean, you've got a very wide net of people who are really offering thoughtful positions. And look, at the end of the day, and we've said this a few times, they're not mandatory, they're advisory. So even if the judge ends up at a place that he or she doesn't want to be, she has the ability to adjust the sentence to what that judge thinks is more appropriate for that fact, for those cases.
We want to thank John Mitchell, an attorney, a partner in Taft's law firm, award-winning attorney, a successful litigator, for coming back and helping us understand this. John, thank you so very much.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Great to speak with you today.
John, we are so grateful. We also know that our listeners are going to, because of you, absolutely be convinced that they have been awarded honorary law degrees because of what you've provided today by way of guidance. So
there you go.
Well, okay.
Judge Gale, why don't you tell people how they can listen to John and to us?
Well, we invite you to keep in touch and to stay tuned to Next Witness, Please. And you can catch us where you find your favorite podcasts. We are found on one of our most cherished partners, NPR, or National Public Radio. But you can also find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon. We look forward to continuing to engage you in meaningful, educational conversations about the law and its concepts so that you can continue to be enriched by this information and apply it where you find appropriate.
If you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can email me, and my email address is hodson@ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you would like for us to cover in the future, please shoot me an email at that address, hodson@ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
And take care, folks.